Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. Are you worried about democracy? I have to confess, I am a bit worried about democracy. That's why I listen to a wonderful podcast called Democracy Works. It's run by the fabulous people at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University. The podcast aims to rise above partisan politics and the daily news grind to take a broader look at issues impacting democracy. These are things we cannot ignore. You can go to www.democracyworkspodcast.com and subscribe in all kinds of ways, or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many other places. We really love this podcast at the NBN, and so much so that we are going to provide you with a little taste of what you can get at Democracy Works. I hope you enjoy the following episode.
Pennsylvania has a long tradition of manufacturing centers. They called them ironworks, places where people came together to build things. This podcast is about building and sustaining our democracy. We call it Democracy Works.
Hello, I'm Michael Berkman, director of the McCourtney Institute for Democracy. I'm here today with Chris Beam, the managing director, and we are very lucky today on Democracy Works to have as our guest Daniel Ziblatt, author of the best-selling book, How Democracies Die.
Yeah, in the biz, it's called a good get.
Chris, there's a lot to chew on in this book.
Yeah, it's a really impressive book.
Yeah, so where do we start?
Well, you know, I mean, I can see this going two ways. The one thing is that, you know, this book is one example of a number of books that are really responding to what is really a worldwide phenomenon about, you know, people thinking that democracy is more under threat, more questionable as a way of organizing social life together than it has been in decades.
Right. I mean, the public really seems to have sort of woken up in really just over the past year, mm-hmm. I think, to what it means to be a democracy and how democracies persevere, or even what I see as really a big takeaway from this book, the idea that democracies and something more authoritarian are not really dichotomies. Mm-hmm. You can get from one to the other.
And that is, I think, the real contribution of Daniel and Stephen Lewicki,
who's co-author.
Daniel studies Europe and Stephen studies Latin America. And so they have a studied background in terms of how it is that democracies transcend and diminish into authoritarianism. And then they say, well, let's just look at this in terms of what's happening right now in the U.S.
Yeah, this idea that democracy can incrementally kind of be eaten away. And we're seeing lots of books about this now,
right,
coming from the right and the left, from mm-hmm. from all directions, interested in this idea. And they're not only looking to Europe and Latin America, they're also looking to America's own past. And
mm-hmm.
and I think it's really interesting what they're doing there, because I think Americans tend to think in terms of this country's constant growth towards becoming a more complete democracy.
Yeah, this expanding notion of what it means to say all men are created equal.
Yeah, exactly right. And what I think is so interesting about this moment right now, and why their book has been as successful as it has, beyond the fact that it's just beautifully researched and written, is that Americans are starting to think about this.
Well, I think you're right. There is this notion among, you know, political scientists, among regular citizens, among everyone, that, you know, we've been doing this for well over 200 years. We got it down. We know what we're doing. And we can assume that things are going to continue much the way they have.
One of the really nice contributions this book makes is that they offer sort of straightforward indicators to understand, for people to understand that you may have just elected an authoritarian.
Right. Yeah. What is important?
What do we need to pay attention
to? And what
do
you need to react the most strongly against? Right?
Right.
It's not just, you know, is it a rude tweet, or is there something else that really merits your concern and your considered response? And that is true for just about every step that the book identifies. In every case, Donald Trump has said things that move in the authoritarian direction. But so far, there hasn't been any real actions that that reflect that same kind of attitude.
Right. Should we all kind of sit back and enjoy the show and say it's really not that big a deal so
right.
long as things are continuing to operate pretty much according to law? Or is there really reason for concern in some of what's being said?
And this is probably a good spot on which to, you know, turn it over, because how democracies die spends at least as much time, if not more, on norms of
right.
behavior, on the idea that it doesn't just matter what you do, but how you do it and what your words convey. And so in that sense, and it directly that issue, how democracies die reflects a very concerned and trepidatious tone about what's going on in America right now.
Well, let's bring in Jenna and Daniel.
Sounds good.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today on Democracy Works.
Yeah, thank you.
So your book, How Democracies Die, which you co-author with your Harvard colleague, Stephen Levitsky. I'm curious if you could start off telling us about what the impetus was for you and Stephen to write this book.
Yeah, well, Steve and I, we teach together. We've taught lots of courses together, graduate and undergraduate courses on democracies in crisis and democratic breakdown and democratization around the world. I work on Europe, and he works on Latin America. So we haven't primarily focused on the United States in our work. But during the course of the 2015-16 campaign season, really the Republican nomination process, we kept running into each other and talking about the tenor of the political rhetoric. And commenting how similar this was and how much it reminded us of politics and the countries we study. And so it was really that made us begin to think that there's something kind of unusual going on. And I think the real turning point came, I think it was in October 2016 at one of the debates when candidate Trump, when asked at one of the debates, would he accept the results of the election if he lost? And he said, well, you know, I'm not so sure. I'll keep you in suspense. And it was really that moment where we realized this is not accepting the basic rules of the democratic game is something that non-Democrats do and that we had seen elsewhere. We'd never seen in the United States. And so we realized that we had something to say on this, drawing on lessons from other parts of the world.
And so where does Donald Trump fit into all of this? Is he did this process of democratic erosion that you describe in the book, did it start before Trump, or was he kind of a symptom of it?
Yeah, and it's a great question because in many ways I think there's a tendency to focus on Donald Trump. I mean, the spectacle of Trump and the latest, offensive tweet or whatever people respond to. But, you know, really one of the points of our book is to say that these dynamics long preceded President Trump, that there's been a long-run process of polarization in American politics, really, we argue, driven initially primarily by the radicalization of the Republican Party, in which there's kind of growing polarization where people on opposite side of the partisan divide have begun to fear each other in ways that, again, reminds us of other countries. But this preceded Donald Trump, and it'll outlast Donald Trump. You know, if Donald Trump is in office till 2020 or leaves office sooner, the implication of our book is really that these dynamics will still be there. And so it's those underlying problems that, you know, we could talk a lot more about that we think are really the thing that concern us.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned political parties. And so what role do you see parties playing in this process of democratic decline? I know you talk in the book about parties, their role as gatekeepers and how they might have stepped away from that in more recent years.
Yeah, so parties are really at the center of the story for us. One of the lessons from the book is that throughout American history, there's been around at least the 20th century, you know, a period for which we have opinion poll data, there's been around 30% of the American electorate that supports kind of demagogic type of politicians. So, you know, whether that's voters who supported Henry Ford, who considered running for president in the 20s, or Huey Long, or Joe McCarthy, or George Wallace, there's a kind of continuous strand of voters that have basically had ambivalent views or not really strong commitments, I would argue, we argue in the book, to democratic norms. So what's changed is not that voters have changed. What's changed is that the role of parties has changed. And so political parties in particular, you know, before the 1970s, the way that parties selected candidates for the presidency was often in what critics at the time rightly called smoke-filled back rooms where party leaders got together. And you know, what's changed since then is the introduction of primaries, which is generally a good thing. I mean, this has made the selection of candidates much more democratic. But the downside of this is that it's made it much easier for a demagogic politician to come along and to gain the nomination of a party.
All right. And so what's the solution to that? How do you kind of prevent the same thing from happening again or from these demagogues from winning elections?
So, right. So, I mean, it's tricky. We don't advocate going back to the days of the smoke-filled room. That's certainly not the case. But there are kind of reforms around the edges that could make a difference. And in many ways, I think our presidential selection system is broken. And we've sort of known that for a long time, but it's only now – it's been right in front of us, but it's only now become apparent after the 2016 election. And so one kind of thing that makes a difference and has made a difference, it would make a difference, is the existence of superdelegates. I mean, so the Democratic Party has superdelegates where elected officials have an extra say in the selection of presidential candidates. So in addition to voters, Democratic Party voters, the superdelegates at conventions have a say. And a lot of people are critical of this and think that we should get rid of this in the Democratic Party. But what's interesting is the Republican Party does not have superdelegates. This is a reform introduced in the early 1980s. You know, had the Republican Party had superdelegates, one wonders, you know, what would have the results look like? Would have Donald Trump actually won the nomination? What if he run and what if he won? So that's one kind of reform.
Yeah, it seems like maybe striking some type of compromise between the smoke-filled back room and a more of a popularity contest,
right,
type of thing.
Exactly.
Right. So something else that we've been talking a lot here about at the McCourt Institute is the kind of constant assault from Washington on the free press. Can you talk a little bit more about what role you see that the kind of assault on the press playing from where you sit?
Yeah, so one of our chapters in our book, we lay out strategies that authoritarian inclined politicians have used around the world, and this is again drawing on lessons from other countries. And once in office, elected authoritarians often we kind of have a sports metaphor, and they try to capture the referees of the political system, so the court system, the, you know, neutral arbiters of rule and law. We say that they try to sideline the opposition. And we also say that one of the things they do is they go after the free press. I mean, this is a common thing, and it's often through very subtle means. It's not the shutting down of newspapers and media stations. So if one looks at what's happened in Turkey and what's happened in Hungary, I mean, although there's been some of that kind of more extreme measures, one thing that has happened in a place like Hungary is that there's been a kind of process of licensing of media, changing of libel laws that make it easier to sue press journalists. And there's been a way in which the kind of control of the media has been politicized, and so that there's a kind of bias in the direction of the incumbents, all intended to kind of bolster up the incumbent. And in many instances, what happens is that the critical press is allowed to continue to exist. But what one sees is the kind of continued existence of a critical press is treated as part of the democratic opposition, and so becomes part of the problem of polarization. And so, in many ways, you know, the press becomes part of the game of politics, where each side is kind of viewing each other as enemy. And there's been increasingly critical views, more and more widespread views, you know, saying that the press is out to get Donald Trump, or it's not giving President Trump a fair shake. And so I think it's hard to imagine. And similarly, sort of along the same lines, actually, Republican voters are increasingly critical and skeptical of the idea that elections are actually fair and free. So if you think that these two pillars of democracy, a free press and free elections, are regarded as significant portions of the population as being not legitimate, it's hard to imagine sustaining a viable democracy in the face of that. So it's very, very worrying.
One of the things that you hear, kind of a counter argument to all of this, is that Trump is all bluster, but no action behind that, and you know, people on the left are kind of wringing their hands over nothing. So what would you say to that?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, so we have this, and in our book we have this, what we call an authoritarian litmus test, which are really a set of indicators attacking the media, questioning the legitimacy of elections, threatening violence or condoning violence. And these are all things that candidate Trump rhetorically embraced before the election. And so people have said, well, you know, he hasn't done much in office. I mean, this has all been talked before the election. In office, he's been largely constrained. And whether one thinks that constraint is self-imposed or comes through our system of checks and balances, one can say, well, you know, what really do we have to worry about? And I guess there I have sort of two responses to this. I think the words matter. And words matter for two reasons. Number one, when President Trump attacks the media and says it's the enemy of the people, when he falsely says that there's rampant election fraud, that this shapes public opinion. The second way that words matter, though, is that they generate fear on the side of the Democratic opposition, the Democratic Party opposition. And this contributes to polarization. And so so there's great increasing temptation for people on the Democratic side of the aisle to use increasingly extreme measures if they feel that they're under assault. This can kind of give rise to a spiraling effect, a tit-for-tat effect, where one has both sides regarding each other in increasingly, you know, frightful terms, and there's kind of fear and loathing across the political aisle. So I think the president has a particular responsibility to hold the line, and because people look to the president and believe the president, both his allies and his opponents. And so in this sense, language matters. So I think even if there was no actual institutional damage done, immediate, you know, action done, I think words matter in a very serious way.
So one of the things that struck me in the book was you talked about, I think it was Venezuela, but please correct me if I'm wrong, that there was a poll done, you know, after its democracy had gone away, and some like astonishing number of people there still thought they were actually living in a democracy.
Right. So that's right. Yeah, it was Venezuela. That's right. Yeah, it's a frightening thing. I mean, I think that's one of the title of our book again is How Democracies Die, and you know, when people often ask us, well, how do democracies die? And you know, we say really they die in two different ways. I mean, during the Cold War, the primary way that democracies died was through these very vivid moments, singular moments of authoritarian coups or military coups. I mean, 3/4 of democratic breakdowns happened this way during the Cold War. Since the collapse of communism, though, given the existence of elections around the world and the kind of general, you know, embrace of democracy around the world after the collapse of communism, the way that democracies collapse now is through elections. And so this often happens in a much more incremental way. And so it's very frightening. I mean, actually, I'm kind of reminded here of a quote from Ernest Hemingway in The Sun Also Rises. A character in The Sun Also Rises was asked, you know, so you went bankrupt. How did you go bankrupt? He said, I went bankrupt in two ways. First, very slowly, and then very quickly. And so I think a similar kind of story, unfortunately, can apply to democracies, that these kind of that the kind of erosion of democracy does take place slowly. And, you know, so we need, and I think in many ways the U.S. is experiencing this. And so to prevent the moment of rapid collapse, I think we need to work very hard.
Right, because once you reach that point of rapid collapse, it's too late, right?
Yeah, and so and I think the way that this actually takes place is through this kind of spiraling effect where both sides view each other as enemies and neither side wants to compromise, and you kind of get into this death spiral where it's really hard to break out of. And in many ways, I think all of us, including myself, have taken our own democracy for granted, and I've tended to think that, you know, politicians can act as reckless as they want and our institutions are strong. But I think that actually, you know, you look around the world, that's really not the case. And so we really, again, part of the purpose of writing the book is to alert people to the basic fragility of our institutions.
And so you also say in the book that democracy is grinding work, which kind of ties back to our whole theme of this podcast, democracy work. So can you talk a little bit more about what that phrase means to you? Grinding work.
Yeah. So that's good. This is a question nobody's asked me before. So there's this distinction. There's a great German sociologist, Max Weber, has this distinction between the politics of ultimate ends and the politics of responsibility. And the politics of ultimate ends, Weber says, you know, what are your goals? What are your big visions in politics? And it's important to have big visions and big goals and high policy priorities. But politics is also just about behaving in responsible ways, democratic politics. And so we, in a way, it's a distinction between process and policy. You know, and so what we think is that often one has to make compromises in politics, in process, in order to you know, achieve one's goals. But what we think at the end of the day is that one has to remain committed to the process, and that one has to, you know, forge alliances with people that one may disagree with on policy terms in order to defend democratic institutions. And so one of the points that we make is that, you know, it's important for Democrats, for instance, who want to defend democratic institutions to reach out to people they may not normally think they reach out to. So kind of, you know, I come from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it's a, you know, solidly blue state. And when people think of their political allies, they think of the kind of usual suspects. But our point is that, you know, in order for democracy in order for Democrats, that is, you know, with a small d, Democrats who are patriots of democracy, they need to reach out to people they may disagree with, business, whether that's business leaders, evangelical Christians, again, groups that they may not normally think of as allies, but people who are committed to the democratic process. People need to kind of find strange bedfellows in a way to remain, who are committed to the process of democracy. And that's hard work. It's frustrating work. It's slow-moving work, and so I guess that's why I call it grinding work.
Right, right. Yeah, and it seems like in our, like, instant gratification age, right,
yes,
more and more difficult to achieve. So your book has been out now for several months. It's been on the bestseller list, and I'm curious if you've heard of what feedback you've heard. Have you heard from any readers, like, I read your book and I did this or I did that or taken action?
Yeah, quite a bit of that. I mean, both in public forums. So, you know, I've spoken in public libraries, and next month we're going to be speaking to the League of Women Voters. And so a public forum where citizens show up, and it's really been quite moving in a lot of ways. Citizens are extremely concerned. And, you know, I think in many ways it's reaffirmed my confidence in American political institutions and in particular civic institutions, but also letters. We've gotten emails, letters, you know, typed letters from people who obviously don't use email. You know, saying that this is, you know, this book has changed how I think about politics. And in some ways, I guess some of the more moving letters have come from teachers. We've gotten a lot of letters from high school and elementary school teachers saying, you know, what should we be doing in the classroom to change how kids think about politics? And what do we do? You know, and people often will say, you know, how do we, in an era in which it's hard to even watch the news because of the kind of the stuff that gets covered in the news, but we want our children to be engaged in thinking about politics, you know, how do we square these two things? And so, you know, this is, you know, made me think that they're really, you know, this is the book. I mean, the book has found this resonance, I think, to a large degree because citizens are concerned. And again, I guess this partly gives me confidence that you know, people aren't taking their democracy for granted. And I think people are sort of really interested in finding solutions. And so there's lots of new democratic activism across the United States. And so we found that very encouraging.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you've received letters and emails from teachers asking how they breach these topics. So what do you say to them? What's your response?
Well, it's, you know, I have to say I don't know. You know, it's, these are really hard issues. You know, I think one of the things in writing this book that I've become more and more acutely aware of. I mean, I've always been, I'm a political scientist, and I've always been interested in the big institutions and institutional reforms, and you sort of think you can engineer institutions to generate better political outcomes. But I've become more and more convinced that there's a set of norms connected to democracy and a culture of democracy. And so on the last page of the book, we have this quote from E.B. White where he was asked in the 1940s, what is democracy? And he describes the sense of freedom that one feels in the public library and in the voting booth. And you know, that's what I think what he's describing is a kind of cultural sense. And you know, that it's a bit nostalgic because he's describing life, you know, in the 1940s. But in a way, I think what our jobs, and I'm a teacher, so one of my jobs as an educator is to generate a sense of that for students. And I think in many ways, you know, one of the things, one area that I think there's some interesting work being done is in teaching children how to deal with fake news. So this is not exactly right on your question, but, you know, so in the my own father grew up in Maine in the 1940s, and he was telling me that in the 1940s, you know, in the midst of the beginning of the Cold War and after having fought fascism, there was this incredible effort to teach children how to detect propaganda. And he still could remember from the fifth grade the kind of key hallmarks of propaganda. And, you know, that quickly kind of disappeared from the curriculum, kind of civics curriculum. But I think in many ways what, you know, there's now lots of work being done and people sort of trying to figure out how can we have our children in schools begin to develop the skills of active citizenry. And I think in a way we have taken this for granted for too long. And I think, you know, people are developing curricula and trying to think about this. And I think that's like a promising area of work.
Great. So we are going to conclude here by asking you some of our Mood of the Nation questions.
Okay.
So the McCourtney Institute runs the Mood of the Nation poll. It is a quarterly public opinion poll, but a little bit different from some of the other polls out there in that it is open-ended. Mm-hmm. So there are four questions that we always ask. I'm looking for your best tweetable responses here.
Okay,
so
we'll
start with pithy, and then you can expand there if needed.
Okay.
So what about politics in America makes you angry?
I think when people can't even engage in debate and hear each other.
Mm. And then what about American politics makes you proud?
Citizens showing up to public libraries to discuss the future of democracy.
And what makes you worry?
Levels of distrust of, again, I guess it's very similar to the first point, levels of distrust among citizens of across the political aisle.
Right. And finally, we'll end on a positive note here. What gives you hope?
I think the anti-gun movement in the high schools in Florida. I mean, this is an incredible movement, again, where I think young people are really understand things that adults don't. And, you know, it's been really moving. And I think that this has the potential to have a transformative effect.
All right, great. Well, we'll leave it there. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Well, kudos to Jenna and to Daniel. That was a terrific interview.
Yes, Daniel, this is clearly not his first rodeo.
Not his first rodeo. And when you have a book on the New York Times bestseller list, you can expect that you're going to get some experience with doing interviews.
Yeah, a really interesting interview. You know, terrific book. So I'm not at all surprised. I was really struck by something he was talking about there when he was saying that words matter.
Right, which is a point that we made in the beginning, right? That this distinction between words and actions is not as bright as a lot of Republicans would like it to think it is.
Yeah. So just to pick up a little bit on what he was talking about with the media, because, you know, you and I have talked about this before, and we see, we see a free oppositional press as critical to a democracy.
Sine qua non, really.
And they do, too. And one thing he was talking about a little bit was whether or not the president's threats against the media have really made, you know, whether they've made a big difference or not. And he points out that they've, you know, that polls seem to show a large distrust of the media. We've picked this up, too, on our Mood of the Nation poll. And interestingly, I think we've picked it up in a way that shows really the impact of the Trump campaign. And that is to say, when we first started polling in 2015, We didn't then, and we don't now, ask about the media. We just say, what are you angry about in politics, as Daniel was asked. And Republicans never mentioned the media early on. They were angry at Obama and Hillary Clinton and lots of other things. But once Trump really started to talk about it, about fake news and attacking the media.
And, and we have numbers of people who trust the media or respect the media. Unheard of lows.
You know, we're recording this as we're kind of entering into the primary season, and we have had candidates in multiple places not answer questions or deny stories based on the idea of the fake media.
And not to mention the fact that other tin horn dictators around the world are picking up on this notion of fake news as a way of just kind of insulating themselves from criticism.
That's what we're seeing in some of these other campaigns right now. Don't worry about that news story from a local media source about something that I did, or because it's just fake.
And I don't have to take it seriously.
Right.
I can just dismiss it out of hand.
And the groundwork's been laid for
that. Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's why there's a First Amendment, because the founders understood that you couldn't sustain a democracy without it. Period, paragraph, right? I mean, it's the First Amendment.
And so just to give a taste of really how interesting and timely this book is, you know, we've been talking mostly about this issue of the media, which is just one small part of what they talk about as the indicators of authoritarian behavior. What I think they do so nicely in that book is to walk through each of these.
Right.
You know, so I mentioned at the beginning that, you know, it's really not that funny when we talk about locking up Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's not that funny is that democracies do not, you know, delegitimize their opponents by calling them criminals.
And authoritarians do.
And authoritarians do. And, you know, it's one thing that, you know, often Donald Trump seems to like to align himself with authoritarian leaders. And, you know, I think a lot of that has to do with he tends to see himself in very strong sorts of terms. I mean, you know, Donald Trump talks about strength a lot. He does not talk about democracy.
Yeah. And the one thing about this book, I mean, you know, both you and I wax emotional on some of these issues. But the thing about this book is it's measured. It's grounded in history and in a, you know, formidable knowledge of how this has happened and the terms by which they evaluate America right now, and especially the Trump presidency, are objective. Right. These are not like, and here's how we're going to trash Trump. That is not what's going on here. Categories, these litmus tests that they set up are meant to describe how any democracy moves into authoritarianism. So we have this book, a really good sense of what we should be looking for and how what we should understand to be important and how we move forward. And that's kind of our job, too. In this podcast. So we're going to be looking at ways that people are talking about with respect to civic education and some other issues coming forward that are particularly designed to address this question of how do we sustain and rebuild norms going forward.
Yeah, looking forward to coming back to that in a future podcast. So everybody tune in. I mean, I think we've talked quite a bit about these kids down in Florida and some of what we can learn
from
them.
And obviously Daniel finds that very hopeful as well.
You know, if we were if the Mood of the Nation poll were in the field this week, I think we'd hear that answer a lot.
I think you're right.
Yeah, so go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast from. Like our podcast,
because
helps it spread more.
We're on social media. We'd love to hear from you. Love to hear what you think about this, what other things you'd like us to talk about.
Yeah, and some podcasts bring their dogs in here, but we're not going to do that.
Well, not yet. We're going to tease that for at least a year before we actually do it.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
All right. Thanks for listening.